Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another episode of Trundlebed Tales. This is the podcast about Laura Ingalls Wilder, historic foodways, one-room schools, and other social history. I'm Sarah Utoff, the host and creator of Trundlebed Tales. Find us around the web under Trundlebed Tales and on your favorite social media platform. If you listen or just have an account on iTunes, please leave positive feedback because that helps people find the show. This is episode 94, Sandra Oliver and the Genealogy of a Recipe. I am pleased to say I'm always glad when we can have Sandy come on the show. And I want to welcome her aboard. And there we go. All right. Hello, Sandy. Thank you for calling
in. Hello. How are you, Sarah?
Oh, just fine. Now, Sandy let me know earlier today that she's had a little trouble with her phone, but I think we're going to be all right. At least I hope so.
I hope so, too.
And I'm going to just quickly here run through our housekeeping, and then we'll be right back to Sandy. So... for our housekeeping, I want everybody to know that they can call in at 714-242-5253. That's 714-242-5 or toll free 1-877-633-9389. That's 1-877-633-9389. And my chat room I normally have open, but it has been being a real pain lately, so I'm going to guess it isn't going to let me in tonight either. But we'll give that a shot, and hopefully I'll get it figured out why it's being annoying pretty soon. And I hope that you will keep an eye out for new episodes. I haven't been doing real great on getting people a long lead time and letting them know that it's coming out, but I have people, not dates, but people having signed up for the next 3 months to be my speakers. So hopefully we will be getting those out in a timely fashion. So watch for it when I do give the heads up. And I think for right now, that's the end of our housekeeping. And with that, we are back to Sandy. So let's start out by you just telling people a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, I've been a food historian for lots of years, 40-something years. I started doing fireplace cooking in 1971 and found myself terribly interested in anything to do with the history of food and dining, cooking, growing food, keeping it, et cetera, et cetera, and have just been working in the field ever since.
And it really is kind of an addictive thing, food history, because you get going and it just draws you in, because as you get going, you want to be more accurate. And as you're more accurate, you need the right food and the right equipment and the right fuel and the right clothes, and you can't get the right stuff, so you start making it and you start hunting through antique shops and you start growing food, and it just snowballs. And
yes,
it really
all that. And those of us who like this stuff often like to cook as well. So you can imagine what happens to the cookbook libraries in our homes. They swell to absurd proportions sometimes. Just new stuff as well as old books.
That is certainly true. I have my Laura Ingalls Wilder Research Building, and one aisle is my mom's cookbook. So
wow,
it is.
Good for you.
So there is certainly, that is part of the addiction too. Well, Sandra was also the editor for many years of the number one food history newsletter in the country, Food History News. And I don't think anything's really stepped into that void. And she also is the editor or writer, I guess I should say, of several cookbooks. And she also did a blog that went along with the newsletter, which is why my blog is called Sarah's Notebook, because Sandy's was editor's notebook. And I always enjoyed reading it.
Well, so, you know, the internet has offered us so many research opportunities and links and connections that I think Food History News used to do that. But I don't. I think that I myself use the internet all the time to do cookbook searches and research ingredients and places and equipment and all that stuff. So, you know, we have that incredible resource and more being added to it all the time.
Well, that's true. But the nice thing about a newsletter is that it's kind of a focused thing, and it comes, you know, with a fairly regularity, and then you can just kind of focus on something. That's the trouble with the internet. It's hard to focus.
It sure is. There's so much that you catch something out of the corner of your eye and you're off like a rabbit down a hole. You know, I mean, it's really hard to stick to your knitting.
It is. So would you like to tell people some of the titles of books that you've written?
Oh, sure. I'm sure. My first one was Saltwater Foodways, New Englanders and Their Food at Sea and Ashore in the 19th Century. And that really was what it was all about. I wrote it for Mystic Seaport Museum, where I was, where I worked for many years. And it just explores food in New England seacoast towns, food in various aspects of the maritime, on board whaling vessels, on board fishing vessels, on board deep water sailing vessels, cargo vessels. And I wrote about chowder parties and clam bakes and how people celebrated all the holidays at sea and ashore. And it had a lot of recipes in it. It was more narrative. It had lots of stories of life in the 1800s. And that was the bulk of the book, but I illustrated quite a lot of the stories with recipes for the particular foods mentioned. So that was first. I also co-authored a book about Thanksgiving with my friend and colleague Kathleen Curtin. That book was published by Clarkson Potter for Plymouth Plantation. We wrote about the history, about 400 years worth of Thanksgiving history, brought it right up to date. I wrote a book called Food in Colonial and Federal America, which is sort of an overview history of the food in all of the colonies, which included not just what we always think of as the original 13, but also southeast, the southeast U.S., which included Florida, and those southern tier states, which later became Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, and so forth, and also the southwest, the part that was settled by Mexico, all up into Arizona, New Mexico, and Southern California. So I also mentioned in the upper Midwest all of the French settlers who moved down the rivers and into Indiana, Illinois, all those areas from Canada. So the colonial America was really a rather large and sprawling enterprise, and we tend to focus on 13 colonies, but there were many more. So that was that. And then I have also written a book called Maine Home Cooking, which is really all modern food. I'm a freelance food writer. So that is a collection of recipes that appear in the Bangor Daily News, which is one of our, I live in Maine, and that's one of the big Maine dailies. I have a weekly column there. It puts me in touch with lots of our old-timers and new-timers both, and we have recipes for everything under the sun. And that's a lot of what I do now, and it's a lot of fun. I guess that's mostly it.
And
that's
if
enough,
you, well, it's certainly quite a bit. And if anybody wants to hear a little bit more about the Thanksgiving book, that was when the last time Sandy came on the show. In fact, I was just listening to it last week since it's Thanksgiving time. And I will be sure to put a link to that in the show notes, or you can find it linked from either my blog or my website, and also directly from Blog Talk Radio if you want to catch it. Oh, and you can also download it from iTunes. Okay.
Good.
Well,
that sounds great.
So what we were going to kind of talk about today, Sandy, is you've been doing these multi-day workshops helping people track down kind of the history of a recipe. So
that's right.
What kind of things do you do in these workshops?
It's really a methodology workshop. It's to give people a whole basket of tools so they can go off and discover everything that they possibly can about a particular recipe. And the recipes we work on really depend on the participants in the workshop. Some people are just dying to know everything that there is to know about bubble and squeak, and some people want to tackle bread pudding, and some want to know about cornbread. So it's just about everything under the sun. And basically, we start out with some good secondary sources, and then generally, after a little while, we start drilling down in cookbooks and every other kind of source we can to find the whole story of a particular dish. So while it's a really intriguing thing to do it, hardly any recipe was ever invented. They're always evolved from something that occurred before, existed before. Americans like to think that, you know, that things get invented, and we're very likely to attribute it to this person or that person and say, well, you know, so-and-so invented such and such a dish. But if you look into the past, you'll see the precedents for all that. You know, recipes are just like people. They're descendants of something that went before, and then in over time, people add stuff to it or subtract stuff from the recipe, suit their own purposes, their own tastes, new or different ingredients, and we end up with a living recent recipe with a long past. I often call these things every dish has a past, and some dishes, of course, have more of a past than others, but they all have one.
Now, the first thing I was going to ask, and I messed up and didn't ask it first, but I think we want to stop and say, so what does food history mean? When someone says food history, what are they referring to?
Sometimes this depends on who you're asking. I tend to make a distinction between culinary history and food history. For me, culinary history is more the history of cookery, how dishes were prepared in a very specific cookery way. For me, food history means a whole lot of other stuff added to the cookery. So, for example, whatever habits people had around eating, what times of day they ate, what constituted a meal over time, who ate at the meal, how did they behave, what kinds of tools and dishes, flatware, all kinds of stuff like that appeared on the table. What was the behavior around food? Who was included at the table, and how are they included? And were there, did people say grace? Was there certain rituals associated with certain foods? Where did food come from the larger world? How much was imported? How much was produced locally? What laws pertain to all of this? What was the trade, the economics, and the social aspects of food? I mean, and the politics of food. I mean, there's an awful lot to food history. Food touches upon just about everything you can think of in our lives, and it does today. I mean, you can listen to the news tonight and hear about starving people in Yemen and why, in a world that has plenty of food, some people still go hungry.
And food's kind of a touchstone for history, too, that, you know, people may not understand some things about history, but food is something that everybody can kind of make a connection to.
Yes, that's really true. When I worked at Mystic Seaport, which is a maritime museum, there were a great many exhibits all about boats and boat building and blacksmithing and coopering and all kinds of maritime crafts and trades. And but people would walk into the Buckingham House where I worked, and they would see me in the hearth, and I'd be cooking. And right away, there was a connection, because everybody eats. Not everybody knows the first thing about how to build a barrel or how to make a small boat or sew a sail, but everybody eats. And all of a sudden, here was something comforting and familiar in this world of very strange and wonderful things. You know, there's something, my gosh, look at that. I recognize that. That's a cornbread, you know. There was something familiar.
Now, we were talking about the history of the recipes, and probably the most direct way that you get the history of a recipe is through your family. Do you think family recipes are important?
You know, I think it is in families where food is important. I mean, you could try this with your own circle of friends. You could say, well, you know, what did your mother cook, and what recipes of hers do you have, or did your grandmother cook, and do you have her recipes, and did anybody in your family talk about what they ate, and why? And when you cook something that they used to make, and you have their recipe in hand, when you cook this, do you remember them? Does this taste like what you remember it tastes like? So yes, it can be important if food and connecting through dining at the table and cooking together was important in people's families. It can also, you know, not to bring too large a cloud over the sunshine here, but you know, in some families, food is a very stressful topic, and people have uncomfortable memories around dinner time. It was maybe a time when everybody was spent so much time trying to keep their elbows off the table and use their forks properly that they didn't really enjoy the food. Or perhaps that was the moment everybody in the family decided to have a big fight. Thanksgiving, you know, people will talk about the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday. And for some folks, it's just this jolly, great big romp, and everybody's getting along. And, you know, Aunt so-and-so brings two apple pies, and somebody else brings, you know, her famous chutney or something. And everybody's just having a terrific time. And in other families, they're absolutely dreading the political conversations because, there's, you know, people on part of the family have a very different point of view than people in another part. So it can be really fraught, but it also can be really joyful too.
So, what are some of the things that can cause a recipe to change or morph into something else over the years?
style, fashion.
Yes.
We're all susceptible to fashion, and certain dishes fall out of fashion. Our Thanksgiving meal has been so far remarkably immune to fashion. Christmas, on the other hand, is subject to all kinds of variations because we don't have a particular meal generally associated with that day. But even so, depending on where in the country you live, you might find that you're adding sweet potatoes to your menu, where perhaps that didn't used to happen in your family. Maybe somebody in your family married a Southerner, or maybe you all moved to Missouri or someplace where, you know, there's a lot of Southern influence. All of a sudden, there's sweet potatoes on the table, where before it was just good old mashed Irish ones. After lard gets a bad name in the late 20th century, so people stop making pie crusts with lard. Instead, they use some other ingredient, and then maybe that ingredient, you know, like the one that comes in the cans, gets a bad reputation, and maybe people switch back to lard, or they just give up and stop eating pie. So
what
all kinds of things
can
happen to a recipe. Ingredients do change over time. Lots of standardization. The flour that our great-great-great-great-grandmothers made their pie crusts out of was pretty different from the extremely consistent product that we get in the store now when we pick up a bag of flour. It's going to be exactly the way it was the last time you bought it, probably the same as it was the last year when you bought it. And you're probably figuring that, you know, in 6 months, or if you get another bag, it's going to be just the same too. So, over a longer period of time, ingredients do change. I often think about the 20th century has offered up lots of ingredients that people used as if they were something you could get out of the garden or out of your pantry. You know, think about all the mixes, packaged mixes that people used and incorporated into their holidays or into just their family's usual routine of meals. Oh, after a while, those ingredients are reformulated by the manufacturers in order to bring costs down or keep the costs down or to make use of a new ingredient that didn't exist before that offers some quality that they want in the in this dish that they're producing. And then if somebody else comes along and you try to use a recipe written down, say, in the 1930s, and it calls for a package of this or a package of that, so you go out and get it, but you get a very different result because that particular ingredient has changed so very much. The 20th century recipes in the future are going to cough up an awful lot of absolutely extinct recipes. We're simply not going to ever be able to make them again. Sometimes it has to do with package sizing.
If anybody hasn't looked at an old community cookbook, and if anyone doesn't know, a community cookbook is one where people in a community or a group of some kind submit recipes rather than one person putting the recipes together. But if you get one of those from the 80s, and one that was put together that says like ounces that a package you're supposed to have and things, it has changed so much. It just is incredible, and it isn't all that long ago.
No, it isn't all that long ago. Yeah, one of the most recent things to crop up in that category, it's going to require real vigilance on our part, is how baking chocolate is produced now. If you go to the store and you pick up a package of baking chocolate, you're likely to end up with something that has 4 ounces in it. Well, you used to be able to pick up something that had 8. The box would hold 8 1-ounce squares, and they were quite little chunks. you know. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, it's thinner. They're advertised as easy break, and they sure are easy to break, but there's only 4 ounces in a box that looks like it's the same size as the one we used to have. So paying attention to not to the number of squares that you have to have, but to the number of ounces you have to have is going to be absolutely, you have to pay close attention and end up with not anything that tastes like what you expect.
And if anybody is writing down their current recipes, make sure you do that. Don't put down one can. Put down so many ounces. Because
yes,
really,
right.
It makes a huge difference.
Convert it into cups, too. You know, if you're looking at a can of, say, a 15-ounce can of pumpkin, that's a scant 2 cups full. Now, you know, if you're making a pie, you probably can get away with it. You know, you don't have to have a full 2 cups. You know, just maybe add another egg or something just to keep the quantity. But in other dish, in other kinds of recipes, watch out. Things can change a lot.
They can. And, I mean, just especially the liquids of it, I think, is kind of bad. Because if somebody's, like I've got a recipe for kind of sloppy Joe sandwiches that I make a lot. That was originally from one of these community cookbooks in the 80s. And
yeah.
I think it was one of the tomato paste, I think, recipe is, I think it was 6 ounces, and now the same can sold as 4. So you have to kind of make up that liquid, or it's just going to be, it would be dry as dust if I just did the one can.
That's right, yeah. Oh, it's so tricky. It really is tricky. This problem has never occurred before in history, so this is a unique thing for we modern cooks to have to think about things like that. And, you know, earlier, I think people just worried about how fresh their ginger was. If you were living on the frontier and you had a recipe that called for, you know, a tablespoon of ginger, pounded and sifted, well, depending on how old your ginger was, you might want twice as much of that. If it was old ginger, it had traveled a long way or sat in a grocery shelf for a longer bit of time, it might have lost a lot of its oomph. So in the past, people would have had to use their noses and their taste buds to determine was there enough in the dough to give them the flavor that they were looking for. And other kinds of problems like that too, you know, similar kinds of situations came up for people. We don't cook to taste nearly as much as we should. I think that's one of the things that cooking schools are teaching us, taste as you go along, to make sure you're getting the dish that you're hoping for.
So, a lot of times, why a story or why a recipe is the same is a certain way doesn't come down with the recipe. And one of the things I think most about is Laura Ingalls Wilder's gingerbread that involves having a cup of boiling water and then pouring the baking powder, I think it's baking powder, into there. And that's not something that you need to do with baking powder. It's from the previous kinds of leavening. And if you didn't know that, you'd have no idea why she was messing around with this boiling water.
That's right. There's a very funny story about that kind of a procedure. I think it's more of a joke than a real story, but apparently there's a family that had a recipe for a particular baked ham that somebody's grandmother used to make, and so the mother said, oh, yes, what you do? The grandmother says, well, cut it in half and put it in the pan like this, and the mother the recipe passes down to the next generation. The mother says, well, you have to cut the ham in half and you know, put it in the pan like this, and then along comes the third generation, and she's told to cut the ham in half and put it in the pan, and she said, why do I have to cut it in half? And the mother says, well, I don't know. So she gets a hold of the grandmother, and the grandmother said, oh, well, I didn't have a pan big enough to hold it without it being cut in half. So that's just, you know, no reason in the world for cutting it in half. But that's the instruction that continued on with a recipe. I think that was a joke.
Yeah, I think so too. And one thing about recipes also is that sometimes you grow up making something in one kind of culture and you don't realize that somebody else is something incredibly similar that was another culture. And I'm always thinking that about Slav countries, because there's so many things that I grew up thinking was only Czech. And it turns out the people in Poland were, and you know, on across the Baltic,
yes,
things were doing things incredibly similarly.
Yes.
And it wasn't really Czech. And even, you know, in completely other cultures, do kind of a similar form of cookies or this or that or the other. So it's,
yes,
kind of interesting to see that too. And they'll usually have a different name, but you know, you look at it and you know that's what it is.
Yes, that's right. That's really true. A lot of celebratory breads, for example, if you, you know, get all those recipes and you just line them up next to each other and just take a look at them, you, what you see is there's a basic and rich dough with lots of, with sugar and shortening and eggs beaten in, and it's yeasted and it's allowed to rise, and then there'd be these little, you know, slight flavor variations from, you know, one ethnic group to another, but the core recipe is this sweetened dough, which, you know, in fact, even the English had brought to this country. And in New England, we made something called election cake. That's essentially a sweetened dough with eggs, butter, sugar, flour, and it's yeasted and it has currants in it or raisins. But it's strongly... strongly resembles a whole lot of other of the same family of cakes. Yeah, I remember back in the Serb, help me remember the other country. This was not that long ago. There was a bitter war in what used to be Yugoslavia.
Croatia.
Yes. Yes, Croatia, that's it. So I remember hearing a report from a reporter there who said that there was one of the ways that this conflict manifests itself was in a bitter fight over a certain kind of a ginger cookie. And she was assured that this particular one was a Serbian ginger cookie, and that one over there was a Croatian ginger cookie, and they were not the same at all. But and people were very firm about this. Until this particular reporter collected two recipes and found they were in fact the same cookie, but you know each ethnic group claimed it and was quite adamant that it was theirs. It's what a pity they just didn't realize they could share it.
Yeah,
find unity in a cookie. Yeah. We use food sometimes to divide ourselves from others.
Mm-hmm. So why would a person want to do a genealogical search for a recipe? What are the people coming to your workshops looking for?
You know, I just don't know, Sarah. I just, I mean, excuse me. I think curiosity. I think it's about curiosity more than anything. I think some people are intrigued by the idea that a recipe can be the product of genealogy. And so they say, oh, if that's really true, then, you know, how am I going to find the origin of this particular recipe? Or they might come kind of determined that whatever it is they have clutched in their hand is unique, and they're going to prove me wrong that this would be descended from something else, or they want to satisfy themselves that it is indeed unique. And so, if you have any curiosity at all about your particular recipe, you might want to dig in and see where it comes from. Where, how did it get to be the way it is now? what were its variations over time, and when does it first crop up? Lots of times, I think people are interested in knowing where does it come from? Where do we get chicken and dumplings? Where did Brunswick stew come from anyway? And is this the same as that, say, in a Johnny Cake recipe? There's all kinds of Johnny Cakes. So is this Johnny Cake the same as that kind of Johnny Cake? And is this a Southern Johnny Cake or is this a Northern Johnny Cake? And how did they get to be what they are now? So I think curiosity is mostly it. At least I hope so, because I think curiosity is a really good reason to dig around for something like this.
So if somebody comes to one of your workshops, what is the first thing that they do?
The first thing I put them to is some good dictionaries, etymological dictionaries, the kinds that give the history of a word by tracing it through several citations found in different kinds of sources from the past, often opens the door to a recipe's history. So, for example, were you to look up a word like gingerbread, you could just look up the word gingerbread in the Oxford English Dictionary or in the Dictionary of American English on Historic Principles, which is unfortunately not a digital. You have to use a hard copy of that. But you'll see in the etymology of the word, its earliest appearance, perhaps, say, in 1763 in some newspaper published in Philadelphia, this particular word would crop up, and then the second time it appears, perhaps in 1803 in some other source, maybe a piece of fiction, or a letter written by someone to someone else, and so on. It follows the history of the word, and it traces its context. And the context tells us an awful lot. It tells us what the socioeconomic status is of a particular dish. It'll tell us something about its region, where it came from. Sometimes we'll go so far as to even describe the dish and how it looked in a particular period of time. So the dictionaries, the etymological dictionaries, are terribly, terribly useful. They're not sufficient unto themselves, however, because usually by the time the word appears in print, a food word appears in print, it has been kicking around a while already. I mean, people have been using it in everyday language. It just takes a little while for it to get printed, written down. And recorded. Cookbooks are also a good source, and they are also more likely to reflect established practice, especially older cookbooks. They reflect what people commonly did. Lots of cookbooks these days are written to change people's cooking habits or to introduce them to a new ethnic food way or to, change in, our habits. Diet cookbooks of various sorts. There's a book out now called Yum Yum Paleo or something like that, and it's all about how to quit eating like you used to and adopt a paleo diet. That's not going to reflect established practice. That's out to set people on a new path. But some book like The Joy of Cooking, for example, which has been around for a long time, that book lays out a long established practice of making different sorts of things. And most early cookbooks were written the same way. They recorded what people did ordinarily. We've got the sort of the history of the word itself, and then we collect some recipes around it. I like it when people look at cookbooks from, a good long period of time, from the earliest one they possibly can find, in the kinds of books we had available for us to use in this country, and then just to follow it all the way through up to as close a recent time as they can manage with it, and then you can compare the recipes side by side and see how it changes. So, for example, supposing you're doing something like a blancmange, which is a nice white, it's a nice pudding that's made with milk and sugar, and is usually thickened with something like a gelatin, for example. And then, in the earliest days, it would have been seasoned with a little rose water. In more recent times, it's going to be seasoned with vanilla. Well, if you write down the recipes and you compare them, you can see when that switch occurred. At a certain point in the 1800s, people stopped using a lot of rose water and they switched over to vanilla instead. Sometimes they stopped off and used lemon flavoring for a little while, and then they went to vanilla. Other kinds of, various thickeners from, rennet to rennet through time, various kinds of gelatins. Gelatin came in lots of different forms, for example. And then, more recently, cornstarch. So you can see when an ingredient drops out, and we don't use rennet very much in our cooking nowadays. It was much more common in the past. We're still using gelatin, and we certainly are likely to use cornstarch. But at one point in time, there was no such thing as cornstarch to use. So you see that. Sometimes you see the two, you'll see ingredients being used in parallel. Some recipes calling for the gelatin, same. Some recipes calling for the cornstarch, and then eventually sometimes the gelatin may fall away, and we're just left with the cornstarch. So all that, you can trace all of that and see how the recipe evolves. Does that answer your question?
Okay, so
how that happens.
What we
try to do is we try to provide some context for the dish, and that's when the story gets really, really fun, because then we can look at travel and description narratives. We can find newspaper descriptions or magazine descriptions of meals or this particular dish being served. We might look for journals or letters written by people who would have eaten it, and that's when we see the dish being consumed by real people in real time, and that's really, really fun. It really brings it alive. It isn't just this one little recipe stranded on a page of a cookbook somewhere. It's becomes a living thing. You begin to see who the people were eating it and what the circumstances were under which they ate it, and that's really interesting, I think.
So where do you find the stuff? If someone is looking to kind of follow those paths and the dictionaries, your library ought to have them, but do you have any favorite place to look for old cookbooks or any go-to cookbook you like to start with?
I really like, there's two or three really nice websites, and you can get to them very easily just by putting it in a search engine and looking for it. But one of the early ones was called Feeding America, and it digitized lots of American cookbooks, and starting with some of the very earliest ones, and then coming up through time, and those are available, and they're searchable. I pretty sure they're searchable. It's called Feeding America. And don't get too confused with there's another website that is Feeding America. It's about feeding the hungry. It's a University of Michigan website called Feeding America. The Cornell University has another set of books online dedicated to the history of home economics, and that also has cookbooks in it. Oh my goodness, there's just so many. Library of Congress, for example, has just digitized a whole lot of community cookbooks. And it's a beautiful site. You go there, you look at it, you see the beautiful covers on all of these things. They have some very early ones and more recent ones. That's a good story. Actually, the Library of Congress has fabulous stuff online. And there's a whole big section just called American Memory. And you could... Earlier we were talking about addictions and getting ourselves lost in looking for information. Oh, my word. American Memory in the Library of Congress is just you could just wander in there for the next 10 years and never come up for air. It's fabulous, amazing stuff available. Narratives, travel description, oral histories, novels, you name it. It's just wonderful stuff. I'll never live long enough to explore half of what I'm interested in that one website. Now there's also crowdsourcing for manuscript cookbooks. Manuscript cookbooks are the ones where women wrote down their recipes, in their own hand, sometimes in little notebooks. We more recently do it on cards, but in past times people had these little hand assembled blank paper books and they wrote recipes down in that. Some of them are quite old, some of them are not so. But a lot of those are being transcribed by people like you and me, Sarah, who just find this an interesting thing to do, and they're being uploaded to various websites. There's one dedicated, for example, just to remedies, and then there's ones that are some of them are dedicated to a particular period of time. Some of them are regional, but they're crowdsourced, which means that there's lots and lots of people out there working away at this kind of stuff. Really great thing. You don't have to have somebody standing on a scanner for hours and hours and hours scanning pages. People are transcribing. Lots and lots and lots of people are transcribing and getting this stuff available for all of us to look at. Wonderful stuff.
So other than just sort of open websites are out there, are there any particular like titles of cookbooks that are your go-to?
Yeah. I mean, I love starting with Hannah Gross, she published her cookbook in England in 1747. And the reason I really find her so interesting is because there are a great many manuscript recipe books that have recipes copied wholly right out of her books. And those women wrote the recipes down, and then they came to this country and they settled here. I'm not quite sure what their motivation was, but I kind of imagined that they saw themselves in a wilderness and they just wanted to have some familiar recipes with them just in case. I like using Hannah Gross. Hannah Gross was revised pretty periodically, with finally an edition published in America in 1805, and it has a whole little insert of what were termed American cookery, which was termed American cookery. I like that. I like E. Smith from the middle of the 1700s. That was another one brought to this country and printed for people to use. We get the first American cookbook, Mia Simmons' book, which was called American Cookery, published in 1796. She's always on my list. American Frugal Housewife by Lydia Maria Child, 1833. Virginia Housewife, Mary Randolph, 1824. The field gets a little crowded in the middle of the 1800s, but I like Miss Parloa, Mary Henderson. There's Dinner Yearbooks. I'll think of her name in a minute. Can't think of the author's name right this minute. But you know, it depends, of course, on where in the country you live. If you live in the South, you're going to want to look at Lettice Bryan's work. You're going to want to look at Mrs. Hale. There's the Virginia Housekeeping, which came out in 1879, which is a community cookbook, actually, but it's just chock full of all kinds of great stuff. Everywhere in the country. Oh, I know who I love is the author of 50 Years in a Maryland Kitchen. Her name escapes me right now, but she seems so personable. I really, I love that book. And Maryland is such an interesting location because it was sort of stuck between the North and the South, and so lots of times edges of places, you know, where it's one way of doing things on one line, on one side, and different way of doing things on another side, you get lots of mixing up, and you see how people cope with tension or trying to blend the two. And that comes through clearly in 50 Years in American, in a Maryland Kitchen. I use Fanny Farmer's original Boston Cooking School cookbook. I like looking at the earliest copies of Irma Rombauer's Joy of Cooking. Those are really, those are a lot of fun. Good to see. She was a wonderful cook, but she also uses tomato soup, you know, and canned soups. Lots of people did. It's fun to see how all that was played out in that era. I usually give up right around the 1940s or so because there was just... there were just so many cookbooks written that it just becomes kind of baffling and overwhelming. That's when I'm more likely to try to drill down on more finite regional things. So that's where community cookbooks from any particular part of the country that I'm interested in, that's a good place to, those are good places to look to see what people were really likely to be doing. I think that community cookbooks are just one step away from a manuscript cookbook. You know, if a woman has a manuscript cookbook, she's writing down the recipes that she likes to use. Chances are it reflects what she's actually doing in her kitchen. She's writing these things down so she remembers how to make a particular thing. A community cookbook, I think, very often reflected what a whole community had. I think sometimes the authors were invited to submit recipes because they were famous for them. And so the cookbook, I think, shows what people actually were doing, not just what they were thinking about doing, which is what your drawer full of newspaper clippings shows. It doesn't show what you're actually doing. It shows what you think you might someday, maybe, if you ever open that drawer up again and dig around in there.
That's exactly right.
The things you really do, and then you have things you sure would like to do maybe someday.
One of the Laura cookbooks that came out is they call it the Laura Ingalls Wilder Country Cookbook. And I like it because it has just gorgeous pictures of Laura's actual, stuff from Laura's kitchen. But from the pictures they show of where they're taking it from, it's like a scrapbook that is cut out recipes stuck into it. And I just don't think there's any guarantee that she ever a single one of those recipes.
No. Yeah, that's a long shot. Of course, if you find one, it's all spattered up. Because it's been kicking around the kitchen table while somebody's been trying to make something, and that's a different ball game. Then you can be sure it was used.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not always. Somebody once told me that they had a manuscript cookbook of their own that they were using in their kitchen one time, and a cat jumped on the table and knocked something over and splashed something all over that particular page. And so you'd get the impression from looking at that cookbook that this person really used this recipe a lot. And it was just the cat. So.
Once in a while, those turn out to be good recipes, though. My grandmother had one for what she called Lazy Daisy Cake, which was a WHO recipe card. And I have the original WHO recipe card she got it off of. But, you know, we made that all the time, you know, all across the family. But I think a lot of those that you clip out, is that's exactly it, the recipes that you'll want to try sometime.
Yeah.
Which is not now, which may never be.
Yes, that's right. You know, I think I think we're all aware that the sense of smell is the one of the senses that triggers memory. If we smell something, we're very much more likely to remember something associated with that smell from another time in our lives. And of course, taste depends partly on the sense of smell as well. If you have no sense of smell, you don't taste things as they are, really. And so when we're cooking something from our family, when we smell it, when we taste it, we're very likely to have all kinds of memories triggered that brings us a little closer to a time that we experienced in our past. And I think that's very precious stuff.
Yes. So we're quickly running out of time. Isn't it interesting? You know, people always say, what will we talk about for an hour? And yet it seems to always go.
I never had a trouble running out of things to talk about food history. I don't know. What about you?
Well, I can talk quite a while. As I always tell people, when that's one of the ways that I end my programs when I'm talking about them, and I ask if there's any questions. I tell them I can do short answers, I can do long answers, I can tap dance.
There you go. Yes, that's right.
So, is there any other source or anything that you'd especially like to point out as to sort of kick us off?
Well, you know, I think, you know, if there's been some really wonderful work done in food history in the past 10 to 15 years or so. And finally, America has its own Oxford Companion to American Food and Drink, and it also has the Oxford Encyclopedia of American Food and Drink. And these are wonderful big sources. Chock full of detail written by people from all across the country about their specialties. So if you're interested in looking up something about, say, Brunswick stew, you can find out quite a lot. And these are wonderful books for people who are just sort of, you know, whether you're working in food as a professional, as a food writer, or as a professional cook and you're just curious, or if you're just someone who's enthusiastic about food and food history, I think you'd find those books very, very valuable. You can find them easily. Just check out Oxford University Press America And you'll see them right there. Those are wonderful things, good sources for people who want to know more.
Okay. Well, Sandy, thank you for coming on and talking about how you look for the genealogy of a recipe, and giving us a lot of good places to look. And I'm going to come up with a list of some of those sources you shared and send them to you first, Sandy, to make sure I've got them right.
Oh, sure.
And then we'll go ahead and get them posted sometime.
Oh, that's great.
Like my drawer of recipe cutting.
We all have one.
Yes. I really appreciate you coming on and talking about this. I'm always glad when we get a chance to talk food history, and I really appreciate you coming on. And I wondered, do you want to give your book titles one more time?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. It was really fun to do this, and I'm terribly glad I had the chance. So, and of course, I wish you a good Thanksgiving as well. Let's see, Saltwater Foodways, New Englanders and Their Food at Sea and Ashore in the 19th Century, Food in Colonial and Federal America, Giving Thanks, Thanksgiving History from Pilgrims to Pumpkin Pie, Maine Home Cooking. Those are the main ones right there.
All right. Well, thank you again, and happy Thanksgiving to you too.
Thank you.
All right.
Good night.
Good night. And for everybody else, thank you for having joined us for this episode of Trundle Bed Tales, and watch for upcoming episodes. And until we meet again, remember to brighten the corner where we are.
¶¶